Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of May 11th, 2012. Happy Mother's Day, all you moms. $2 billion. That is how much money JP Morgan Chase says it may have lost in just the last few weeks because of risky stock market trades. Maybe that is why so many Americans have stopped investing.
We have this steady downbeat of news coming out of financial institutions and financial players who are misbehaving.
We'll ask what the finance industry is doing to stop that behavior. College graduates are drowning in debt, and if you've had experience with the system we use to pay for higher ed, you know why.
Well, I think it is broken, and I think a lot of the blame for that lies, actually counterintuitively, with student aid.
Arguments for and against financial aid and whether you have the right to go to college. Plus, we'll visit the local ball field where kids are kicking up dust and running the bases while parents add up what they've paid for all that gear. Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
JP Morgan Chase went to Vegas, put it all on red, and lost $2 billion. Okay, not exactly, but close enough. You may have heard this week that the country's biggest bank reported at least $2 billion worth of trading losses from just the past 6 weeks. Traders made bets on risky derivatives and lost. Gee, does this sound familiar to anyone? Well, earlier in the week, the CFA Institute, that's Chartered Financial Analyst, announced a global campaign to, quote, improve the investing public's trust in the investment industry. Well, we spoke with its president, John Rogers, prior to the JP Morgan news, and I asked why he thought the public's trust had eroded.
Two things. First, stock market returns have been very volatile for the past 10 years, and we've had a rolling 10-year period when the Dow has basically returned nothing. And second, there's been a steady drumbeat of bad behavior hitting the press, starting with Madoff, going on from there, MF Global losing their clients' deposits and what have you. And so we have this steady downbeat of news coming out of financial institutions and financial players who are misbehaving. And those two things really keep people on the sidelines.
Yeah, because, you know, I think a lot of the American public looks back at the last, 10 plus years and, starting with Enron and WorldCom and all those scandals. And yet still, bank CEOs are being paid these huge salaries and bonuses. They seem to be rewarded for taking huge risks with our money. So I think a lot of people look at the system and wonder what has changed.
Well, and a lot has changed. The financial services sector lost over 200,000 jobs worldwide last year. So the pain is being felt. And to us, it's about the industry remaking itself fundamentally in the best interests of the clients. And that is what we have got to get people back on track with. And it requires trust in the investment profession and the investment professionals.
Then how are you going to get that trust back? What are some really concrete steps that you're going to take? Because, you can ask pretty much anybody to be a more ethical person, and there's no guarantee that they will.
Well, to us, imagine if the medical profession found itself in a crisis of confidence, if there were physicians out there who were quacks and practicing and acting unethically.
Well, they'd be pursued by prosecutors, which has not happened with the financial industry.
Absolutely, they would. And also, other physicians, ethically practicing physicians, would call that out. And so we've just published something we call the CFA Institute Integrity List, 50 ways to restore trust. And one of them is to require training on ethical decision-making for each of our firms. Make sure that that's happening.
But I'm sorry, why do you need training to be an ethical person? Can't you just do what's right for your client?
It's a great question. The finance industry is inherently full of conflicts of interest. Of course, anytime an individual is asked to look after someone else's wealth, there is a temptation called agency conflict to step in front of the client. And so right out of the box in finance, there are conflicts of interest. And that's why our members have a code of ethics and standards of professional conduct. We make them attest to that every single year.
I guess for a lot of people, it's just hard for them to see how you are going to square this notion that you've been talking a lot in op-eds and in the talks that you're giving about stewardship, how you square that with the very basic need in this industry to make a profit.
Well, the best way for the long term to make a sustainable profit in financial services is to ask yourself three questions. First, how are my clients doing? Second, how's my firm doing? And only last, how am I doing? And if we keep those questions in the correct order, then financial institutions have the opportunity to make sustainable profits for the long run, not overnight.
I guess perhaps for a lot of people, the indication that things have changed will be if we go without a financial crisis for a longer period of time. You know, maybe 5 years would be good.
Isn't that true? Well, what we've learned is that some sort of financial crisis in some corner of the globe seems to occur just about every 7 years, almost biblical in nature. So it's not whether or not crises will occur, they will. It's whether our portfolios have been invested in a way that we can achieve our long-term objectives. And that's always a challenge, Tess.
John Rogers is president and CEO of the CFA Institute. That stands for Chartered Financial Analyst. Thank you so much for coming in.
Tess, great to be with you.
All right, already. Fine, Uncle. Despite our insistence, our wise insistence, week in and week out, that it is not smart to invest in individual stocks, you've been begging to know how to own a piece of Facebook. It's going public on Friday, and apparently there is indeed a way to get in on the frenzy. Frankly, I think I'll take the day off and go hide in a cave somewhere. But for those of you who just can't turn away from that bright and shining light, here's our senior business correspondent Bob Moon with some friendly advice.
The official video supporting Facebook's stock offering includes an idealistic pitch from Mark Zuckerberg, who in the same week he turns 28 stands to see his personal net worth ring up to more than $15 billion. He vows not to forget the 900 million users who make up his empire.
In everything that we do, we really want to honor the fact that this is a network of people and that we're all here because of the people using Facebook.
As if to show he's not just offering platitudes, Facebook has included the online retail brokerage E-Trade on the list of firms distributing the initial stock. Fidelity and Charles Schwab are also taking requests for shares, and the New York Times quoted unnamed sources as saying as much as 25% of the more than 300 million shares being offered could be allocated to retail investors.
I like the spirit of it, and if nothing else, it shows that they're serious about trying to get a little more of their user base involved.
Joe Mager is a senior analyst at the Motley Fool investors website.
900 million people. That's a pretty good business case for letting some people in on that.
A survey by the Motley Fool found the buzz is attracting attention, especially among relatively novice investors, 4 in 10 of whom said they're planning to buy Facebook shares. When I spoke to financial planner Robert Pagliarini at Southern California's Pacifica Wealth Advisors, he'd just taken a call from a client determined to get in on the action.
Who, strangely enough, does not use Facebook, but is excited about this IPO and wants to buy in.
Pagliarini is skeptical, though, and tried to talk her out of it. Even individual billionaires are classified as retail investors, and they have a much better chance as the favored clients of the big underwriters. So Pagliarini doubts many smaller customers will have much luck landing shares at their issue price.
If someone could get in at the IPO price, I would say go for it. I think it makes sense. Would I be a buyer if I wasn't in at the IPO price? No.
Pagliarini points out E-Trade is taking conditional orders, minimum request around $15,000, which the firm's website says will not guarantee an allocation of shares.
This just qualifies you to potentially, possibly be a Facebook owner.
Translation, don't get your hopes up. But what if you just can't resist the urge to own a piece of Facebook? Pagliarini expects the price to pop when trading starts, and buying then could turn out to be just as risky as some other recent tech IPOs, which quickly saw stock values dip. Still tempted? Pagliarini recommends capping your price with a commonly used tactic called a limit order.
You're saying, I really want to buy shares of Facebook, but I want to set the maximum price that I am willing to buy it at. If I can buy it at $50 or below, let's do it. More than that, forget it. I'm not interested.
Or you might just consider what the Motley Fool's Joe Mager plans to do.
I'm going to watch Facebook for a few quarters before diving in. I think it's a great business, but an expensive stock. I'd like to see what some results look like before I hop into the pool.
If you insist on jumping in now, Mager cautions, remember that you'll be swimming with sharks. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
All right, so maybe you're dreaming of rolling around in all that cash you'll make from Facebook's IPO. Well, if that is your dream, we want to hear about it and any other money-related dreams you're having. Actual dreams, you know, while you sleep. We'll be talking to a psychologist in the next couple of weeks about dreams and money. So let us know via email on Facebook, or if you can fit it into 140 characters, tweet me at Radio Tess. Indulge me for just a moment this weekend while I wish Julie Vigeland the happiest of Mother's Days. I could not have asked for a more beautiful mom inside and out. I love you, Mom. And with that, I relinquish the microphone for someone else to express her appreciation, as commentator Jen Miller does for her mom, Mary.
I am my mother's daughter. We are carbon copies of each other, separated by 26 years. I see her every time I look in the mirror. And I think of her every time I put money away in my retirement account, make a mortgage payment, or toss money into my emergency savings instead of buying something I don't really need. My mom didn't graduate college. She took night classes, but she married young and had four children by the time she was 30. When the youngest was in kindergarten, she temped, and within a year had a full-time job as an administrative assistant for a financial planner, a boon since, when my parents divorced, she needed to work. She was about to take a certification exam to become a financial planner herself when her father was rushed to the ICU. A hole had ripped open into his stomach, and he suffered a stroke. She still took the test, but understandably did not pass. Further study went out the window as she helped care for him until he died. She did the same for her mother, who passed away a few years later. Then the recession hit. Her investments tanked, and the value of her home dropped by nearly a third. So she got a second job, working nights and weekends at a grocery store. Some members of our family whispered that they were embarrassed she worked there. I was not. She did what she needed to do to keep saving for retirement, pay the mortgage, and replace the roof on the house she still needed to sell, which she did this year. She found a buyer almost immediately after it listed and then negotiated a blockbuster deal on her new home. In April, she quit the second job. She went to Ireland. She renewed her Match.com profile. At 57, she has made an amazing comeback. I am proud of my mother. She has been an inspiration in both preparing for my financial future and the rest of my life. Happy Mother's Day, Mom. I can't wait to see your next chapter.
Jen Miller is author of Book a Week with Jen, 1 year, 52 books, and the year of starting a new chapter. Stay tuned later in the show because we got a little something for her mom. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland. Time in the show to hear from you, dear listener. And with me to help do that is our dear senior producer, Patty Hirsch.
Hello, Tess.
Do we have a full mailbag this week?
Oh, we've always got a full mailbag on Marketplace Money. Always.
Excellent. And everybody loves us.
Everybody, well, yes, everybody loves us.
Okay.
Not everybody's so keen on Peter Morici, though.
Yes, our commentary from last week about the subject we have covered quite thoroughly here, student loans.
Yeah, so he addressed a number of issues in his commentary, including the tendency of many students to study liberal arts degrees that he implied might be less than useful in today's workplace. So we got a lot of mail about that.
I found that my liberal arts degree did quite well, thank you very much.
Well, it's done well for you, maybe, but Peter was making the point that it might not do well for people entering today's workplace where perhaps more practical skills might be more useful.
Yes, science, technology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So Lynn Slater wrote in to say that liberal arts is where students broaden their thinking skills and their creativity and hopefully their sense of ethics. And all of that, she says, has been sadly lacking in the graduates of B schools.
Ah.
Right. And David Robkin wrote in. He said that he found Peter's comments deeply offensive. He said, the value of college cannot be measured by debt-to-earnings calculations. People are more than their jobs, and any society that forgets that is doomed to collapse under the weight of its own feudalism.
Oh, dear.
Strong
that,
words,
that
right.
Sounds like someone with a drama degree.
Yes, the liberal arts are at least useful when you're writing letters to marketplace money.
Definitely.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else that we can answer for listeners?
Yeah, we had some really interesting sort of little sort of scrappy questions, consumer advice type things.
Consumer advice.
Yeah, yeah. So, and Simon Jones of San Diego wrote in. He wanted to know if claims from subscriptions can show up on your credit report.
Oh, man. You know who I wish was here?
Who's that?
Our good friend David Lazarus.
David Lazarus, yeah, but he's...
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
oh,
oh, oh, oh,
oh, David!
Oh, what's that movement in the trees?
Oh. I was just driving by. I heard the words deeply offensive on the show, and I figured you were talking about me.
We so, were, indeed.
So I thought I better stop by.
Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you very much.
I do have to say that I was really, really sorry to see this week that... that Brad Pitt got the contract over you for Chanel No. 5.
How? I mean, what a blow, right?
I mean, could not believe
first
it.
First the Nobel Prize for Literature, and now this?
I know!
Where does it end, right?
What is that?
I, okay.
Life is so unfair.
It was a little rough, I have to admit. And the fact that he got Chanel No. 5, and I'm being tentatively offered Tidy Bowl, I'm not necessarily happy about how it's breaking down, but, you know, I'm going to rise above this.
Excellent. Well, you can rise above it by helping us answer this question.
Can do.
Do you get magazine subscriptions, David?
I do.
Yeah?
This is kind of a Sarah Palin question. So I'm going to be very careful
right
here.
It's not whether you read them or not. It's whether they come to your house.
I read all of them. You know, all of them. But yeah, I think a lot of people do.
Okay. So we have Simon Jones, wrote in from San Diego. He wants to know if claims from those subscriptions can actually show up on your credit report at any time.
In other words, if you're not paying your bill.
Right.
They can. Now, typically, if you're not paying any sort of subscription or dues, the response from the dues receiver is to drop you.
Okay.
And you know, basically a subscription or dues are for services rendered in real time, mm-hmm. basically. And so you're not going to really accrue that much of a debt. But if for any reason you have accrued a debt, then indeed they can come after you. Probably they won't. They're just going to say, well, that's a fine. How do you do? And then 2 weeks later, you'll be getting new solicitations saying, oh, please come back.
Okay. Here's another quick hit for you. Christopher Angel, also from San Diego. He wanted to know if he can consolidate his and his wife's credit cards, the ones that they had before they were married, without impacting their credit score.
So same card issuer. Yep. They're both carrying balances. Right. Can we put it all on one plastic? That's the question.
Exactly. Without affecting the credit score.
And I would say almost certainly no. Almost certainly this move will involve your credit score in one way or another because one of the cards is now going to take on more debt.
More debt. Mm-hmm.
That's a factor. Also, anytime you close down a card, even though it seems counterintuitive, that too can impact your credit score, albeit only on a temporary basis because creditors look at that and they think, what's going on? Something a little funny here. And you're going to see some minor movement. I would think, though, that it's a smart play, consolidating onto one card. It simplifies, and since they're a couple and since it's the same issuer, not a bad move. Figure it will take them maybe 3 months, 4 months, 5 months to bring the credit score back from any possible movement.
Right.
I'm always a big fan of simplification when
so
it comes
to finance.
You can just
go ahead and close it down.
I would do that, yeah.
All right. What else do we have, Betty?
So a while back on the show, David was talking about getting data from lenders in order to find out how much you really owe, you know, when your loan has been sold on to somebody else. And you said that, you know, you need to email the lenders or call the lenders and get all that data from them. Shannon Snyder did exactly this. She followed your advice. She's a school teacher from New York, and she has a follow-up question about that. Shannon, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Shannon, tell us exactly what your situation is. What happened?
Okay, here's the situation. While I was in graduate school, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, I took out about $40,000 in student loans through a local bank,
okay.
which has since changed hands multiple times. Like, it's had three or four different names. And I think the loans should be already paid off by now, but I called the company, and they say I still owe $22,000.
And why do you think the loan should be paid off by now?
Well, I refinanced them in 1999 mm-hmm. with a 10-year kind of payoff period.
In other words, as of 2009, you should have been free and clear. That's what you're figuring.
Right. But I had it set up through automatic withdrawal through my bank account. And because it was automatic, I just sort of forgot about it until I heard the show. I thought, oh, these should be paid off by now. So I went to look into it, and the company has a different idea.
But did you end up calling the company to find out what was wrong?
Yeah, I called them, and I also called the Higher Education Services Corporation
mm-hmm.
because when I stopped paying the company, I got reported, and they just say, nope, you owe $22,000, and according to their records, maybe that's the case because they only really have the records from 2004.
Have you asked them to furnish you any of the original documents that they have?
Yeah, I asked them for the original promissory notes, which they had.
And did that include, like, the payment history of the loan and all that sort of thing?
No, no payment history from 1999 when I refinanced until 2004.
So have you called them since you got all this paperwork to say where's the rest of it or what happened here?
No, I haven't. I was waiting for some divine intervention.
Oh,
and here I am.
Here he is.
There you are, David.
Yeah, obviously someone has their wires crossed here, and it either stems from the 1999 refi of the student loan or the 2004 acquisition of the thing from the thing, to use the financial terms. And you know, someone at some point didn't press the button that does the thing for the thing. And so it sounds to me, Shannon, like you haven't done anything wrong except not being on top of the situation. And I do want to emphasize to you and to everyone else, you can't take things for granted. This is really important. If you don't watch out for yourself in today's eel-infested financial world, no one will do it for you. Now, in this case, I would say that the lender or whoever holds your loan at any particular moment has a fiduciary duty to maintain adequate records.
Yep.
The onus is on the lender and not on you to be able to prove the situation. And so if the lender is unable to cough up that documentation, it doesn't mean necessarily that you just have to trust whatever the lender says. Moreover, you would have pretty good grounds for a lawsuit at that point.
Oh, okay.
If you wanted to go back and say, no, prove that I owe this much because my understanding is and my records show that this should have been paid off by 2009. The onus is on the lender to prove otherwise at that point.
But what if the next step is for the lender just to send an intimidating letter to Shannon saying, hey, We're coming after you with collectors, et cetera. So, I mean, you know how
that probably will be the next step.
And they just might. And then she ups the ante with a letter from a lawyer.
Right.
And you don't need to retain one full time. You can just simply go to a lawyer and pay to have a letter written. And I advise this to people all the time when they get into problems with big corporations. How do you deal with it? It's worth spending the $200, $300, $400 that it might take of a lawyer's time to just simply write something on letterhead with that threatening lawyerly tone about it that sort of makes it clear to the corporation that you're not someone to be trifled with. And what you've also accomplished there is to enhance the paper trail in your favor.
I had a little interesting aside. Along with my records, when I requested them, the company also sent me 4 pages of someone else's personal documents, including everything about her. Her social security number, where she was born, where she went to school, her mother's maiden name.
I'm not thinking a lot of this lender at the moment.
No.
And I would think that case you were just building for negligence on the lender's part, you just made it a whole lot stronger suddenly.
Okay, well, that's good. I called her up and I told her that I was not planning to steal her identity and move to the South Pacific.
She must have been thrilled to hear from you.
She sounded kind of perplexed.
Yeah, I would think so.
Well, I would hang on to those documents, or at least a copy of them.
Yeah, Patty's right. Do hang on to them, because if you did end up going to court, this is Exhibit A.
Yep.
That this lender doesn't have its act together.
Okay. Well, that's good news.
Does that help you out?
I think so, yeah.
Thanks for calling.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Thanks, David.
You betcha.
Thanks for coming in, Patty. And,
that's a pleasure, Tess.
We'll hope to hear from everyone again on Twitter and on Facebook and any other way you decide you'd like to communicate. visited a Los Angeles Parks and Rec field in the suburb of El Sereno recently. Dozens of kids and their parents spending a sunny Saturday morning with baseball. More than 40 million kids play organized sports in this country, and their parents spend a lot of money to keep them outfitted and involved, $5 billion in the aggregate. But of course, that number doesn't mean anything. So we asked Minerva Brambilla of Montebello what she spends. She was watching her 5-year-old nephew attempt to make contact with the ball. Her own son is 13 and plays baseball and golf.
The kids just grow out of their stuff every year. Every year.
So new uniforms.
New uniforms, new helmets, new baseball bats, batting gloves, cleats, gasoline with all their games to be traveling from one city to the other.
Can you estimate at all how much you might be spending every year?
The uniform, it depends on the park. It could range up to $100 and maybe $70. And that just comes included with one pair of socks. And then your practice gear also, about $60 a helmet.
So you're looking at minimum $500 or so?
Or so, yeah.
So what does that do to your family budget?
It brings it down, but it's, in my opinion, I think it's well worth it for them not to be out and about doing bad things or mischievous things. Keeps us all going.
A few yards away, Edmundo Ramos of El Sereno watched his 8-year-old daughter playing in a Dodgers uniform.
Well, it's not about how much you spend on the kid playing sports. It's about what they're learning on the field. You know, they're learning how to take commands from the coaches, from parents, you know. And it's about supporting the kid playing the sport.
But it's not free.
It's not free, that's for sure. It's $65, you know, to enroll your kid in sports, get the uniform, the socks, and the trophy.
And the trophy.
And the trophy.
Which is the most important part.
Right. Right. Out the door, probably come out to about $80 with the glove and helmet and the shoes. It's all worth it, you know. It's supporting the park system. You know, it's helping other kids play baseball. So getting kids off the streets, that's the main thing.
Now, these are not unseemly amounts to spend, but in his new book, The Most Expensive Game in Town, author Mark Hyman investigates the multi-billion-dollar industry that surrounds all this fun and games. And he says that $5 billion figure we mentioned earlier, it's just a baseline.
I think that's quite a conservative number because there are many categories of expense that it doesn't really capture.
And it's very abstract, too. I mean, $5 billion, what does that mean?
What does it mean and what does it include? And in the book, I dismiss the significance of that number. For instance, if your kid is going to a travel tournament out of town, and for many families, that occurs multiple times a year, you're buying gas for your car. You're eating at the pizza restaurant. You're staying at the motel 2 or 3 nights. None of that is really captured by the number that I cited. So it's very difficult to understand what the number really is. In terms of individual families, for most families, the number is in the thousands of dollars. If you have a youth hockey player in your family, the number easily can be $10,000 to $15,000 a year.
Man.
But for many parents, it's not simply money going out. There's the expectation, or the hope at least, that there may be a payoff down the road in the form of a college scholarship, or for those who are really dreaming big, maybe even a professional sports career for their child.
Well, so that's really where the rubber hits the road, isn't it? Such a big part of this arms race is that you have to get a jump on all these other kids. What goes into that thinking on the part of the parent here?
Well, it's very difficult to value what you're buying in the youth sports economy. For instance, I wrote a story about 18 months ago for the New York Times, and it was about sports training for babies. And I'm not kidding. There are companies that are in the business of producing DVDs for children as young as 3 months old.
And like, what, quarter-pound dumbbells or something like that?
Well...
Oh, don't tell me that actually exists.
Do you want to know? There's a company based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. They produce a series of DVDs for children under the age of 1.
Oh, good Lord.
And in one of the videos, the child, the infant, is seated on the lap of the parent, and the parent is dropping a balloon at the child, who then has a paper towel holder in their hands and is trying to, with the assistance of the parent, trying to swat the balloon with the paper towel holder. So, but it really speaks to, I think, our vulnerability as parents, because it's very difficult when you see the child across the street signed up for the soccer clinic at age 3. It takes some discipline as a parent to make the decision that it's just not the right time for my child. You don't want your child to fall behind.
Talk to us for a moment about how you yourself have fallen into this.
You know, I've made 95% of the mistakes that I write about in these books. My son was a baseball pitcher. I was his coach. He had an injury, came to me after one game and said, my arm is feeling tired. I asked him, do you think you could pitch tomorrow? Which is probably not the correct parental response. My son ended up having Tommy John elbow surgery. Look, our goal as parents is to help our children reach their potential as athletes. I think what we're doing is not consistent with that. In fact, I think oftentimes we're creating obstacles. We're preventing our kids from reaching their potential as athletes because our kids are playing the same sport year-round. And many kids are just dropping out of sports because they're emotionally burned out. I mean, 75% of kids drop out of organized youth sports by age 13. So now, to me, the answer to, you know, raising a healthy sports child is to let them set the agenda.
Right.
You know, follow the lead of your child. And don't worry so much about whether they have the $25 bat or the $300 bat. And the material things really aren't what separates the great athletes from the also-rans.
The book is called The Most Expensive Game in Town, The Rising Cost of Youth Sports and the Toll on Today's Families. And we've been speaking with the author, Mark Hyman. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland. Earlier this week, it happened, officially. America's student debt burden passed $1 trillion, according to FinAid.org, which has a clock running on its site. The average student graduates college with $24,000 in loans, but for many of them, that's just a drop in the bucket.
My name is Christy Bush, and I'm from Silver Spring, Maryland. I have $50,000 in student loan debt. So I spend a lot of my free time worrying about my future, and I actually feel really helpless.
My name is Daniel Carr, and I'm from Ashland, Oregon. I'm in a teaching program, and when I finish it, I'll probably be $65,000 in debt. I'm a little frustrated that it costs so much to become a teacher.
My name is Emma Lang, and I'm a curator at a historical museum in Los Angeles. I owe more than $50,000. It's very frustrating to be a young person right now and seeing nothing but debt ahead of me because it will take me even longer to be able to afford a house, say, or afford to have children, or in the case of many of my friends, afford even to get married.
So, college costs are rising 8 to 10% a year. Graduates are facing an economy with 8% unemployment, and employers are demanding college degrees as a bare minimum. This issue is even gaining traction in the presidential campaign. So we're joined for a conversation by Robert Reich, former labor secretary, current Berkeley professor, and author of Beyond Outrage, and Neil McCluskey, associate director of the Center for Educational Freedom at the Cato Institute. Welcome to you first, Mr. McCluskey.
Thanks for having me.
And Robert Reich, welcome to you as well.
Well, thank you, Tess.
Let's start with something of a philosophical question. We are told over and over again in this country, while we are children, that a college education is the main way to get ahead in the world, that this is how you're going to put yourself in the position to attain the American dream. If that is the case, do we have a right to a higher education? Is it something that we should all expect to get if we work hard enough to get in? Should we all have that chance, regardless of our ability to pay? Robert Reich, let's start with you.
You know, when you talk in rights language, Tess, it kind of loads the dice a little bit because nobody wants to think that everybody has a right to everything. But in terms of it being important to the country, important to individuals, something that ranks very high up there in a public value, education certainly and higher education? Well, I would think so, given where we are and where we need to be competitively and also as a society.
Neil McCluskey, if you work hard enough, if you get in, should you be able to go regardless of your ability to pay?
Well, first of all, that's not really a right, because if we talk about a right, that is something that everybody has, and it would be regardless of their demonstrated aptitude for college-level work. It would basically say everybody gets to go to higher education. And let's not forget, a right incurs an obligation on everyone else to pay for that. And I think if you look at the history, even before the GI Bill, which people say this is what really drove most people to college, what we saw was people who were consuming education commensurate with their needs, rather than what we see now, which is lots of people going to colleges and universities who first of all, don't finish. So you've got about 80% of first-time, full-time students who go to a community college. They don't finish their program, at least within 3 years.
80%?
80%. 40% of first-time, full-time students don't finish a four-year degree within 6 years. So ultimately, what it comes down to is government provision, whether it's based on the idea of rights or not, has led to massive overconsumption and lots of people with huge bills that they can't actually pay because they didn't complete those degrees.
Is it fair to say that college is a primary path to success in this country? And if so, then should the government have a role, and what role should that be in helping you get there financially? Professor Reich?
College is a primary role to success. Most of the studies show that if you complete 4 years of college, your earnings are about 70 to 80% higher than, on average, than people who only complete high school. The interesting question is why we don't have other opportunities, other tracks for people other than four-year colleges. I mean, it shouldn't be that in this country the only way and the only path to success is a four-year college degree. Other countries, like Germany, have very, very good technical and vocational tracks where people who choose not to go to college still have a very good chance of making it. That is not the case here in the United States.
Well, let's move on to talk about the kids who have gone to college, many of them now grown adults with huge student loans. Let's talk about the way that students end up paying for college in this country. You've got cash, maybe some scholarships, most of them not very significant, and you have loans. Is the way that we pay for college broken, Mr. McCluskey?
Well, I think it is broken, and I think a lot of the blame for that lies, actually counterintuitively, with student aid. It's the aid that largely drives the inflation that we're seeing, and loans are a big part of that, especially loans that essentially anybody can get and that typically have much lower interest rates than a truly private lender would offer, because that private lender has to price in the risk of somebody not completing a degree or completing a degree that doesn't help them earn more money.
Robert Reich, what happens if we don't have a financial aid system?
A lot of young people, particularly those from low-income families, just will not be able to go to college. This, ironically, Tess, comes at exactly the time when the income ladder has become elongated. So naturally, it's harder if you're at the bottom to go up that income ladder, particularly when some rungs in the middle of the ladder, they used to be called good manufacturing jobs, paying good salaries for non-college graduates, have disappeared.
So then, Neil McCluskey, if you do somehow get rid of a financial aid system, how do you make sure that kids from underprivileged families are able to go to college, assuming that they do the work to get there?
I think what has to be kept in mind, especially if it's true, which I think the evidence is really overwhelming, that student aid has enabled prices to rise so high, and has also led to lots of waste in higher education, both in students consuming a lot that they don't need, spending a whole lot of additional time socializing rather than studying. If you see how much waste there is in college, what you can clearly see is if you were to reduce the aid, first of all, colleges would have to lower their prices because most people wouldn't be able to pay them. And then they'd have to cut out a lot of those major, major inefficiencies. The result would be that college would be more affordable for everyone.
Well, let's keep talking about the folks who have student debt. This, of course, was one of the big rallying cries of the Occupy movement last fall. But there are plenty of people out there, including a number of our own listeners, who say, look, you knew what you were getting into. You should have done the math. It's your responsibility to pay it off, not mine as a taxpayer, not the banks to absorb it. So why should we have any sort of forgiveness program or even go back to when, you know, you could declare bankruptcy with your student loans? Can I get your thoughts on that, Robert Reich?
Yes, I completely understand the point of view that says, look, it's your responsibility. You didn't have to take out these loans. But on the other hand, if you want to succeed in today's world, you don't have much choice. I mean, if you're a poor kid from a poor family or even a lower middle class, what we used to call working class kid, you really do have to go this route. You've got to try. And if we don't provide a route to try, whether it's direct financing by taxpayers of public higher education, or indirect financing through a loan system, then we are cutting off upward mobility in this country at a very, very critical time when upward mobility is desperately needed.
Neil McCloskey?
You know, I certainly feel for people who have big student loans. There also is a tendency to overblow the degree to which people are burdened with debts. And the average debt for somebody who has it, and it's only about two-thirds of graduates, it's only around $25,000. Now, that's probably too high, but that's nowhere near what we tend to see in these anecdotes. And the reality is you are investing in your own human capital with the goal of ultimately earning a lot more. And on average, people who finish college do earn a lot more and pay that money back. You've got a real concern then that at the very least the aid should be in the form of loans, because otherwise, if it's just grants or it's subsidies to public colleges, you are taking people money away from people who often need it for other things and would use it for very productive purposes, and you're essentially just giving it to someone so that that person can earn more. That's called stealing.
If I could, Tess, I just want to provide the other side of the argument here, because undoubtedly there is some truth to the notion that if the public provides a lot of support in the form of student aid or else subsidized loans, it does encourage colleges to increase their costs, and that has been shown. But that argument can easily be overstated. What's happened over the last 4 and 5 years, particularly as state budgets have been dramatically cut, is that the states have actually pulled out of the business of public higher education. And about 75% of all students in colleges and universities today are in public higher education. And that means that the price inevitably is going to go up because there's less state direct support.
Well, let's conclude perhaps by talking to the high school sophomores and juniors of the world who are making decisions, even at this point, about, you know, what they're going to do and where they're going to go and how they're going to pay for it. Let me ask each of you to kind of deliver a lesson to them of what they should prepare for and how they should think about what college is going to mean for them and what kind of value, dollar-wise, they should be ready to put on it. Robert Reich?
First of all, I advise young people to try to imagine themselves in the future. What kind of work would they like to be doing? What do they think that they might love? I would hate students who are burdened with student debt to have to give up a dream if they want to be a concert pianist or if they want to be a social worker. Why give up that dream because you've got to pay back a college loan?
So you think the cost of their education should not be a factor in their decision?
I think a cost of education has got to be a factor, but I think it needs to be less of a factor than it is right now. I mean, somebody's work, their career, what they're going to be spending their time doing is something that has got to provide meaning to them. And ideally, it's got to improve the world a little bit. If it's just thought of as a return to investment, we are cheating ourselves. We're cheating our country and we're cheating our young people.
Neil McCloskey, what's your message to these high school kids?
Well, I think the first thing we'd want high school kids to think about is, do they really want to go to college or just doing it because everybody else is and people tell you you should do it? I do think it's important, as Professor Reich has said, that people also think about, is what they are studying something they really want to do? If that's the case, then college will be more meaningful for them. They will put in probably more effort on average. Where I disagree, though, is the notion that the public should be essentially paying for someone to pursue a dream, even if there's great evidence that dream can't pay for itself. And I think that is the root problem with higher education. And ironically, that's led to all this student aid, which has led to the price of higher education becoming astronomical, which has made it a huge burden on everyone.
On that note, thank you both for an amicable and enlightening discussion. Neil McCloskey is the Associate Director of Cato's Center for Educational Freedom in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Robert Reich is former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration and also teaches public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can hear our full half-hour conversation at marketplace.org. year, we explore the cost of kids' sports. Well, this weekend, a documentary film called First Position opens across the country. It's about the Youth America Grand Prix Ballet Competition. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith spoke with one of the dancers featured in the film to learn the cost of becoming a professional ballerina.
At the Manhattan Movement and Arts Center on New York's Upper West Side, dancers line up at the bar practicing jumps. 14-year-old Miko Fogarty is at the center to practice a piece from Giselle. She danced this routine a couple weeks ago at Lincoln Center for the Youth America Grand Prix Ballet Finals. She says getting there took 10 years of daily grind.
Normally I have an open class in the morning and then a private with my teacher for like 45 minutes. And then I have class and then I go home and then I do my homework. I normally take like one day off a month or 2 months.
The classes Miko's talking about are all ballet classes. Miko does her schooling online. Her routine is chronicled in the documentary First Position. Bess Cargman directed the film. Cargman says she was stunned by how much work and money it takes to go pro.
It's incredible, a commonality between any family that is extremely serious about a child making it as a dancer. The fees are astronomical.
My name is Satoko, Miko's mom.
Satoko Fogarty and Miko list off some of the expenses associated with trying to be the best in ballet.
Miko needs like classical tutus, which we ordered in Japan because there's a really, really good costume maker. Yeah, this costume is like $2,000, which is normal. Then I needed six tutus, which is for $12,000.
My pointers are around like $90 to $100, and I have about two or three a month.
$35,000 for tuition, which is includes class and private lesson. Almost 6 days a week, $35,000 a year. That's at least, it might be more.
We have to go to ballet competitions and we have to travel for that, so we have to pay for the hotel and the competition expense and the flights.
It all totals about $50,000 a year. Satoko Fogarty admits she's never added it up before.
My husband tells me to budget, but I can't budget. And I see this figure and I'm sort of surprised today.
The risks of investing so much money in your budding ballerina are extreme. The aim is to become a professional dancer, but injury rates are high and salaries are low. Ballet dancers start out earning about $60,000 a year, and pay raises are rare. That's if you can get a job in the first place, says Cargman.
Since 2007, 2008, companies are shedding dancers. They're rarely hiring them.
Careers are also pretty short. Dancers usually go pro around 17, and a lucky dancer will retire around age 40. But Miko says she wouldn't choose any other career.
I just would feel like something's not complete in my life. Like, I loved performing on stage so much. It brought so many emotions, and I loved the process of working with your coach or teacher.
Miko plans to go pro in a few years. It's her dream to dance with the Royal Ballet in London. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Haddon Heights, New Jersey. That's where commentator Jen Miller's mother, Mary, lives. Jen's description of her mom's financial wisdom makes her a shoo-in this week. So take care of Piggy. I know I don't have to worry about you feeding him. By the way, our pig is on Twitter and taking nominations. You can follow him at Piggy Award. Boing, boing. Boing, boing. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, we introduce you to a unique subculture here in L.A.
I've won $51,000 cash and a trip to Rome. And the trip to Rome, they always say it's worth $7,000. But, I think if you wanted to do the same trip, it wouldn't cost that much.
The world of semi-regular game show contestants. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
This is APM.